You're listening to Nick Treadwell's Storyville. Terrorvision, a confession. How I was psychologically scarred by horror films as a kid. Written and narrated by Nick Treadwell. Part 1. There was no place to hide from kids' TV. As the small screen in the corner faded to black and credits began to roll, I breathed a heavy sigh of relief. Another edge-of-the-seat, stomach-churning, sweat-inducing experience had come to an end. A continuity announcer wished us all a pleasant, peaceful night and closed the station down with the obligatory national anthem. My folks quickly turned off the box and we all climbed the stairs to our respective bedrooms. I undressed, checked underneath the bed in case a hideous ogre had somehow accidentally made its way into my room, turned off the light, climbed under the bed sheets, and lay there, in the darkness. Totally alone. Feeling only semi-safe under the covers, my mind unable to quieten the irrational thoughts swirling uncontrollably around my head, did not allow my body to rest. It was too busy replaying the unholy scenes from the film I'd just watched. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw a decapitated head whiz past me. Outside my window, a full moon glowed and I heard the far-off howl of a wolf. I quickly pulled my legs up from the bottom of the bed as something huge tried to bite into my feet. I clutched my chest as something monstrous fought to free itself from within. And then a luminous fog began to swirl mysteriously under my bedroom door and, for a split second, a dark figure appeared at the bottom of my bed holding a long, bloody knife. It was no good. I was a nervous wreck. I leapt out of bed and made a run for the light switch, just narrowly avoiding the dark shape of a man holding a pair of shears aloft, the smell of burning flesh filling my nostrils. I spent the rest of the wee hours waiting for the first rays of the sun to lift the darkness outside, and only then did I close my eyes and let my poor, tired body relax and drift off to sleep. The aforementioned routine was part for the course for me during the late 70s and into the 80s, because during my childhood and teenage years, I was routinely terrorised by horror films. The visions and ideas they placed in my head would stay with me, plaguing my waking life until they were eventually replaced by the doldrums of everyday life. School, homework, chores, or even the next horrific late-night onslaught of terror. Maybe it was because my mind was innocent, young and impressionable, or that I was a sensitive loner type who found it hard to make friends. But for whatever reason, even though I felt compelled to watch these cinematic heart stoppers, partly so that I didn't feel left out the next day at school as my peers and I recalled the gruesome details, I really didn't have the constitution for it. Most of my friends seemed to lap them up, to the point of bragging in competition with each other that they had watched more times than anyone else, those ranking up the most watches being held in high regard. Of course, I too would mention nonchalantly that I'd watched along and enjoyed the blood and gore, failing to confess that I was actually left psychologically scarred by the experience, that my mind was still playing tricks on me for days after the screening. Get them early. So when did all this start? They do say that most of the fears and phobias we suffer in adult life are triggered by events in childhood. Well, from an early age, we are indoctrinated into the world of television by that seemingly innocent of all genres, children's TV. Our parents would plonk us in front of the Gogglebox to keep us quiet so they could get on with more important things. Little knowing, however, that some of those shows were having a rather unnerving effect on our equilibrium. Of course, remembering the nostalgia of scary kids TV has become quite popular nowadays, with blogs and books overflowing with reminiscence and nostalgia, so I won't dwell on what's already been said elsewhere. Suffice to say that perhaps one of the earliest kids TV shows I would have been subjected to, and which, looking back at it now, does leave a slightly unsettling taste in the mouth, is The Pipkins, ATV 1973 to 1981, the UK's answer to The Muppet Show.
Pipkins. There's Pig.
And Hartley.
There's Tortoise.
And Hartley.
There's Topov.
And Hartley.
Pig, Tortoise, Topov.
And Hartley. Hare.
I could have been witnessing this rogues gallery of regionally voiced puppets from as little as 4 years old. The show centred around the workshop of Mr. Pipkin, a puppet maker, and his assistant Johnny. The puppets themselves were lovingly original, handmade and a little rough around the edges, perhaps even a little off-putting. The ringleader being a mischievous, egotistical, threadbare hare named Hartley. The kind of soft toy you might throw in the bin for being past his best. He was a veritable Frankenstein puppet who looked like he'd been stitched together by an evil puppet maker, not the kind Mr. Pipkin we knew and loved. He might as well have been suffering from severe neglect or rabies. His character was tricky, slightly dour, and prone to fits of revenge. Elsewhere, there was the scrunchy-faced pig who was always hungry, a cockney-voiced monkey, and a French ostrich, to name but a few. But it was always Hartley that ruled the roost. The show had a monotonous voiceover narration by Nigel Plaskett, who also voiced and puppeted several other Pipkin characters. I always found this narration to be slightly sinister. The show would invariably start something like,
"Mr. Pipkin and Tortoise were having a doze. Mr. Pipkin and Tortoise were fast asleep. They didn't hear the telephone."
But it so easily could have been, "Mr. Pipkin and Tortoise looked like they were having a doze. They didn't hear the telephone, as they had been bludgeoned to death by the evil Hartley Hare, who was going to cook them up for his flesh-eating sidekick, Pig." Another show that provided both a fascination and some shocks was the Sunday tea time favourite Wurzel Gummidge, Southern Television ITV 1979 to 1981, starring John Pertwee and Una Stubbs. I mean, what could be more scary than a man made out of straw, complete with long pointy nose, grimy teeth and a face caked in mud, suddenly coming to life? Oh, not only that, but with a range of spare turnip heads that he could interchange like the wheels of a car. Wurzel was regularly losing his head, quite literally, and had a range of strange associates who, quite frankly, looked like they had just walked straight off the set of some bizarre rural horror flick in which two children get lost in the country and end up being held hostage by a terrifying psychopath made of straw and his wooden-faced aunt who keeps serving up cups of tea and slices of cake to fatten them up before murdering them in cold blood. The ending of one particular episode, called The Crow Man, broadcast in 1979, would have been particularly harrowing for 10-year-old me. After begging the Crow Man for a handsome head that he can use to get himself a wife, Wurzel, as usual, gets more than he bargains for when he tries to woo a particularly ugly, mud-caked scarecrow lady that he comes across in one of the fields, resulting in a gruesome attack and the dismembering of several limbs and his head.
Good afternoon, man.
First off, I've come to humbly beg your pardon for what I said to you this morning. That was before I was handsome inside, at one of them. I didn't mean it when I said I'd knock your head off. Second, I've brought you these flowers, and you can have them for nothing. I'm giving you these flowers because I want you to be my wife, you see. I want you to know that you're the most handsome scarecrow I've ever seen. As handsome as me, so you are. and I'm asking you to marry me. If you've got life in you, same as me. So if you've got life in you, and you want to be my loving wife, would you nod your beautiful head? There's no coffee in a laugh. He's got that cackling and coy. There's nothing here.
I'd like to say that school was a safe space in which my mind was allowed to remain free from the fear of terror vision, but this, alas, wasn't the case. A seemingly innocent BBC schools education programme called Look and Read featured a serial in 1980 called The Boy from Space, which meant that those of us who found ourselves in primary school would be sat cross-legged in front of a specially wheeled out television housed in a wooden cabinet and subjected to the strange story of Peep Peep, the blonde-haired, shiny-skinned alien boy from space who makes friends with two human children called Dan and Helen.
Out there in space, shall we find friends? Is there
Peep Peep is chased by the rather menacing Thin Man, who first appears and chases after the children in a disused quarry.
He came towards us. He was tall and thin, and he had a mac and a hat on. He looked very pale and strange.
Yes, I know it's hard to believe that kids would play freely in such dangerous places back in the day, especially by today's standards where kids hardly leave the family nest. It's not so surprising then that my friends and I were a little traumatised by the thin dude. I mean, he was dressed in a long Macintosh overcoat, wore a trilby hat, had a pale drawn face and weird searching eyes. Bloody hell, he was the stranger danger our parents warned us of whenever we left the house to go out and play. Add to that the shaky camera work and sinister synth electronic soundtrack, and you have the makings for the perfect recipe for a nightmare. For many of us, this show might have been our first slice of sci-fi, and there's no doubt, as such, it would have lingered in our minds long after school was over. Look and Read had a strange format. During the middle section, there would be a focus on education, grammar and punctuation. This was all set in a space station above the Earth and presented by the floating presence of Wordy, a round foam-headed creature with arms and stubby nose covered in the letters of the alphabet. Wordy's human assistant, Cosmo, provided the calming influence to rein Wordy in when he lost the plot and got carried away, which he often did to our annoyance. There were also catchy, well-performed songs to back up the learning from the wonderful Derek Griffiths. So, one minute we'd be spaced out by the Thin Man's antics and the next tapping our feet to
I'm an apostrophe, come and take a look at me. I'm not a comma, I'm not a full stop, don't put me on the line, I go at the top.
Before being thrown back into the story for a cliffhanger that would stay with us night and day until next week's episode when the TV would be rolled out again. In 1984, John Wyndham's 1968 sci-fi novel Chucky was turned into a six-part TV series for Thames Television. Matthew, played by Andrew Elams, is a bright, intelligent and annoyingly smarmy 12-year-old who is telepathically chosen by an alien entity that wants to learn more about life on Earth. His poor parents then have to put up with his endless questions and strange schizophrenic behaviour. Almost from the off, Chucky is inquiring about everything from gender and sex to why there are 7 days in a week.
Mum?
Yes?
Why do we have men and women?
How do you mean, darling?
Well, why do we have two sexes? Why are they so different?
That's a difficult one. But I suppose they're different because men and women have different functions in life. It's all to do with hormones and things.
But why do we need two?
Well, you have to have male and female to make babies.
Yes, I know that. But what I want to know is why. Why do we have to have two to make one? Doesn't seem very efficient, does it?
I don't know. I've never thought about it like that. It's just the way things are arranged.
Yes, but how did they get arranged like that? And why?
I've no idea. What a strange question. Look, perhaps you and I could talk about this another time, eh?
Okay.
She, stroke him, laughs at humanity's continued use of the wheel, which it sees as old-fashioned and tries to explain how we might use a more sustainable source of energy in the future. Soon enough, the special abilities that Chucky bestows on Matthew become known to those with a vested interest in such useful and lucrative knowledge, and the boy is kidnapped for several days. It all gets too much for his mom, who nearly has a nervous breakdown. I certainly remember watching this unusual show after coming home from school and being literally transfixed by the notion that there could be alien life outside of our sphere. It must have fueled my later interest in the possibility of ETs and aliens, and it dealt with some pretty serious issues for a children's show. For instance, mental illness, telepathy, possession, and abduction, to name but a few. Chucky was followed by two other series, Chucky's Children and Chucky's Challenge. Other televisual hauntings in my teens included a character from a rather unusual BBC TV show called Jigsaw, 1979 to 1984, called Mr. Nosybonk, played by Adrian Headley. This was a creepy guy who went around trying to help kids solve puzzles. He wore a dinner suit complete with bow tie, a white mask with an oversized nightmarish grin planted on it, and a huge protruding nose, of a similar type to that worn by Alex in the film A Clockwork Orange. It wasn't so much watching the show that gave me a problem, more that it fueled my peers at school to call me by the same name on account of my hooter being, well, let's say, a little on the lard side. So I was cursed by the character by way of a kind of osmosis through my friend's cruel name-calling. Public information films. Perhaps one of the main culprits for scaring the willies out of kids in the 1970s was those British public information films, PIFs, made to deter kids and adults from doing things that they shouldn't. There were loads of these that were aimed at kids and were shown during children's programming. Perhaps one of the most terrifying was The Spirit of Dark and Lonely Water, 1973, which featured a deathly hooded figure voiced by Donald Pleasance, welcoming the demise of various kids who by some foolish means had met their end by falling into the watery depths of lakes and ponds filled with old cars and bedsteads.
That pool is deep. The boy is showing off. The bank is slippery. The show-offs are easy. But the unwary ones are easier still. This branch is weak, rotten. It'll never take his way. Only a fool would ignore this. But there's one born every minute. It's the perfect place for an accident.
He laments as a boy thrashes about in the water. I don't know about other kids, but this particular film put me off swimming for life. I didn't even want to go and swim in the safety of the swimming baths. What if my leg gets trapped in a rusty old door of a submerged Austrian Allegro, I told my mum. Hence, I didn't set foot inside a public swimming bath or learn to swim until I was at least 40 years old. Quite a few of these PIFs were aimed at frisbee-playing, kite-flying, soccer-loving, model-playing enthusiasts. One minute, a group of innocent kids wearing tank tops and flares would be playing in a field. The next, some kid had squeezed through the bars of a substation to retrieve his frisbee-stroke-ball-stroke-model-plane-stroke-kite, which had conveniently wedged itself between two electrical conductors. I was just glad that my name wasn't Jimmy, because he was always the one who seemed to get it, having 30,000 volts pass through his little body. Yes, those pesky overhead power lines used to spoil all of our fun in the 70s. You couldn't move without being in danger of going up in a huge human fireball. Even those lucky kids whose parents could afford sailing boats were targeted in one film where some kids foolishly manoeuvring a boat with a tail mast under, yes, you guessed it, a power line, get more than they bargain for, and all to the rather similar suspenseful music of the Jaws soundtrack.
Those wires alive!
If you want to have fun and stay alive, keep away from overhead power lines. Then you know you'll be playing safe.
If it wasn't power lines, it was strangers with sweets. And if it wasn't strangers with sweets, it was broken bottles on street corners or escalators mauling Wellington-booted kids. And if not that, then it was rabid pets or playing with matches, drunken drivers or running like headless chickens after Mr. Whippy or trying to remember what John Pertwee told us Splint stood for so we could cross the road safely. We sang the pedal safety song so that we could be seen at night on our bicycles, and we listened stupidly to Jimmy Savile telling us to clunk click with every trip. It was a wonder that children ever ventured outside. Death, it seemed, was at large and waiting around every corner. These films were probably responsible for the fact that I spent most of my time outside of school hours within the safety of my room. In fact, I used the excuse of imminent nuclear war many times with my mum to get out of going to school on a triple maths day. Not that it ever worked, though. But perhaps the ultimate PIF, the one which had the potential to cause the highest body count and the most nightmares, was the handy Protect and Survive series of films which, amongst other things, told us how to survive the impending nuclear apocalypse by creating an inner sanctum from a spare door we might have lying around the house, or how to safely dispose of the dead bodies of our nearest and dearest, or the very difficult choice of what to put in our fallout room.
After an attack is over and the all clear has been sounded, arrangements will be made as soon as possible to treat any people who are ill or injured. Listen to your radio. Details will be given about what to do, when to do it, and how. If anyone dies while you are kept in your fallout room, move the body to another room in the house. Label the body with name and address, and cover it as tightly as possible in polythene, paper, sheets or blankets. Tie a second card to the covering. The radio will advise you what to do about taking the body away for burial. If, however, you have had a body in the house for more than 5 days, and if it is safe to go outside, then you should bury the body for the time being in a trench or cover it with earth, and mark the spot of the burial.
These films ran between 1974 and 1980 and haunted my childhood like the ghostly spectre of death himself. Watching all these films back, it has occurred to me that kids nowadays wouldn't really need warnings such as these, for the very reason that most of them never actually venture outside to play, opting instead to stay inside on their consoles and screens. But I suppose that even there, in the seemingly safe environment of the parental bosom, there are hidden dangers just waiting to prey on the innocent and young. The anonymity that the virtual world affords such stalkers has allowed them to groom, abuse and traumatise a whole new generation. Perhaps then we need a new series of public information films placed onto platforms such as YouTube or wherever kids consume content, so that once again they can be safely scared enough to know what to do when in a dangerous situation. In revisiting and watching some of these old kids' shows I watched as a child, I have once again been reminded of the breadth and scope of the strangeness we were subjected to on a daily basis. But those shows paled into insignificance compared to the hardcore horror films I was allowed to stay up and watch next. Thanks for listening to this episode of Nick Treadwell's Storyville. Please subscribe if you liked what you heard, and be sure to check out my Substack blog, Letters from Storyville, at nicktreadwell.substack.com.